Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Hello and welcome to Season 2 of the Modern Adventurer podcast. I'm your host, John Horsfall. I'm an adventurer and photographer, and each week I'll be talking with a new guest about their latest adventure from around the world. For all the new listeners and subscribers who have joined, I speak to adventurers and explorers who do remarkable things in the field of exploration and endurance. This is an immersive podcast, so this season their story is cut to music and cinematic effects, as we immerse ourselves into the heart of their adventure. My next guest is a British explorer and filmmaker who is at the forefront of modern exploration. From the Arctic to the rainforest, she has pursued all sorts of expeditions around the world. On today's podcast, we talk particularly about the rainforest and the hostile environment that she had to encounter on her latest expedition in the Amazon. Our story is out there, and to tell it firsthand, I am delighted to introduce Lucy Shepherd to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to get you back on. We had you on episode 18 talking about one of your latest expeditions. And today you are fresh back from your other expedition out in South America, which we will talk about later on in the podcast. But for people who haven't listened to that episode or who don't know you, who are you, what do you do, and how did you get into this sort of life of adventures?
Yeah, so who am I? I'm Lucy Shepherd. Yeah, I would best describe myself as an explorer. I think we don't hear that term very much anymore, the term explorer, but I most definitely think we should use it unapologetically now. I think we can all be explorers in our own right. For me, personally, I use the term explorer because, well, in my most recent expeditions, it's the best way to describe and explain what I do. So I've been doing expeditions for over 10 years now. I started when I was 18. I was lucky enough to be picked to be one of 10 to go off to the Arctic of Svalbard for 10 whole weeks. So we were completely trained up. I had to learn the first taste of fundraising, which, as anyone who does adventures knows, that it's pretty much the hardest thing about doing anything like this, the fundraising. But that was my introduction to that, as my introduction to the wilds. After that 10-week expedition, it was just one of those feelings that that's the best version of myself, and how can I just keep doing this? I just loved every aspect of it, really. The challenge, the camaraderie with the team, the being sort of so connected to the environment. And from then I just made it my mission to try and get on as many expeditions as I could. Started hanging around the Royal Geographical Society, politely pestering people. And it worked. I started sort of getting more skills, high altitude mountaineering and things like that. And I've been sort of professional explorer for a number of years now, but I've gone full-time explorer since last year. And it's looking like I can stay that way, which is amazing. And that really is, I suppose, a childhood dream when I was 18, thinking that maybe with that one day I could be Lucy Shepherd explorer and like be full time. And so now to actually say it is pretty great. And it's been a bit full circle, actually, because, yeah, I've recently got back from South America, but also I was just guiding myself in Svalbard, so where it all began. So 11 years later, I was guiding myself. And we had an interesting encounter with the polar bear, but everything was fine. But it's great to sort of see things, everything clicking together. And looking forward to sharing more of Guyana and South America on the podcast today.
Well, I'm sure people have a lot of questions, which hopefully we'll answer today. So, I mean, like when we spoke last, it was your trip in the Amazon and you were talking about going out there again. Mm-hmm. Which is a story you're going to tell today. So in terms of the planning for this trip, for people who don't know you or anything about sort of expedition planning, how did this sort of come about, this expedition?
Yeah, goodness. I mean, the expedition planning with this was huge. It started, so my previous expedition in the Amazon that I did in 2020, I finished that trip and I thought it was clear that there was so much left to explore in that area. It's a very unknown area, the Kinuku Mountains. There's not much about it online. Half of it is protected. So that's when you Google it, that's what you'll find most of all. But in terms of people actually going into the ground, into the deep jungle, people don't do it. It's a place filled with myths and legends. It's got a lot of fear surrounding it as well. There's sort of knowledge of uncontacted tribes and things like that, whether or whether or not that's true, mythical creatures that live in the jungle, all that sort of thing. And the only maps that we have access to are 50 years old, but they're very unreliable. So basically a Canadian 50 years ago flew over, it was a pilot, took some pictures and then just did some drawings from those pictures. So as you can imagine, when you're looking down at a canopy with using a camera that's 50 years old, it wasn't accurate. So I looked at these maps and I finished this expedition and talked to kind of like a mentor, Ian Craddock, this guy who ex-special forces, lived out in Guyana, finished this last expedition in 2020 and said, look, I really want to do something big. And he just looked at me and said, you're going to have to cross the whole thing now, aren't you? Meaning cross the whole Kinuku Mountains. And technically the whole Kinuku Mountains goes further than it looks like it does on the map. It starts from the Essequibo River, so the mighty Essequibo River close to the Suriname border. And it goes all the way to the Brazilian border. So all the way west to the Brazilian border. And it's a huge, huge distance. I mean, it's like, it spans, I mean, we ended up walking over 400 kilometres, but as the crow flies, it's about 200, 250 kilometres. And everyone thought this wasn't going to be possible. They thought it was not going to be viable at all. I was sitting here in a hotel in Georgetown in Guyana. You know, the beeping from outside as you get in all of these South American hot countries, the humidity. And I just thought, well, that's got to be it. This the impossible is going to be made possible. And so I went home. Ian and I started planning. We started planning this trip. But just a couple months later, he tragically and sadly and suddenly passed away, which was a big blow. Obviously lost a friend, but also lost this wealth of knowledge. He had so many contacts in Guyana that was going to make the planning so much easier. He had government contacts. It's not like you can just go to the Kinuku Mountains or most places actually and just walk. You have to get permissions, you have to get permits, all sorts from the likes of tribal chiefs who technically own the area to the protected area committee. So it's just endless. I mean, these countries love paperwork. They love paperwork and permits. And so when he passed away, it was kind of like, is it going to be viable? Is it just too much to ask for me to organize it? Luckily, one of my good friends and also Ian's good friend as well, Anders Andersen, who's a good friend, Danish guy. He said he'll come on board and we'll do it in sort of Ian's name and we'll work together to make this possible, which was incredible. So it was a two-man band. It was myself and Anders who organized this. And it took months. We probably spent full time on it for about 6 months, but as everything, as it got closer and closer and closer, it was a tidal wave of organization and everything was thrown at us. We had to deal with a lot of authorities. We had to deal with last minute changes. We had to deal with COVID, of course. So much preparation so we had two resupplies that we had to organize. There was only two options to have resupplies that were economical. And that were the two major rivers that we would cross. So we would have, we had to plan that Anders would have a boat, come from a boat for a couple of days journey from the nearest village and drop off a barrel full of food, then leave them at coordinates and let us know the coordinates. And then we would find it there. So there's all that sort of thing, as plus the rescue, organizing sort of a rough route. The list went on and on and on. And it did feel like Anders and I just constantly had a tennis racket and problems that were the tennis ball were thrown our way. We just kept having to battering. And it's a fun experience. If you've been on expeditions before, you know that nothing ever goes to plan. And you have to be so reactive, and you just have to think, okay, how are we going to sort this? How are we going to sort this? Once you're there, there's no choice. You're going to do it. But yeah, it was a mammoth task, and I'm very proud to have even got to the start line, to be honest.
Because your expedition before was also up in around Guyana, well, in Guyana.
Yeah, so
in the Amazon. So surely with that knowledge and that wealth of experience, that surely helped with the planning of this trip, did it not?
100%. So previously I'd done a shorter route through the Kanukus from south to north. And what that had done is it had almost given me a bit of, credit in the bank for the authorities, for the governments there, and also for the indigenous Amerindian people to know that what we were doing, you know, I could do it and I could lead a group there. It also introduced me to so many contacts of my team. So what the expedition we were proposing most recently was so mammoth that it wasn't like I could just take anyone that was strangers. Luckily, because I knew people, I had trust, I knew their capabilities. So I took people who were, you know, my friends already from previous expeditions, which was a real, gave you a head start. But yeah, no, I don't think I could have just gone without any past experience in the country doing expeditions.
What was the sort of moment, because you obviously, as you said, with all the sort of funding, with all the sort of paperwork, visas, government officials that you had to sort of put in, what was the sort of moment where it sort of all came together and you're like, right, we're off?
Not until the boat dropped us off at the insertion point, because we had right up until we were even dropped off. I mean, I think we might come to that in a little bit, but right up until we were dropped off, we were having things going wrong where it could have been the end of the expedition. And, you know, the expedition itself, anything could happen on any step. So I don't think I really realized that this was possible until finally got out of the jungle safe. All those, you know, months later, and realize, okay, now I can breathe. Anders and I can breathe a sigh of relief, because although I was in the jungle constantly, Anders was in civilization on the edge, a few days contact away with a sat phone, hoping nothing came his way.
Well, let's jump into the story and let's head over to the Kanuku Mountains. And so the idea was probably to fly from the UK over there, and it sounds like there was all sorts of challenges that erupted along the way.
Yeah, so in late September it was time to finally leave. I flew from the UK. Anders was already out there. He'd been out there organizing things for a couple weeks. You land in Georgetown. Georgetown's a very vibrant city. It's quite Caribbean-esque. There's people from all over, really. So there's Caribbean people, there's almost like Brazilian type people, there's a lot of some Dutch people from Suriname, and it's very, very multicultural, and it's a very fun city. But you arrive late at night and the airport's full with people trying to offer you taxis as usual, and jump in a taxi and finally meet Anders, and there's just so much excitement in the air that what we've been planning for months is starting to happen. And after a few days of getting sort of last minute supplies, we had to arrange all the resupplies for food. We were finally meeting the team in Lethem. So Lethem is our last point of civilization, really. It's a couple hours journey from Georgetown, and Lethem, it's a town, but it's a very basic town. There is kind of Wild West, like it's no tarmac roads and just dusty roads and very, very hot. And on the side of Lethem, you look out at the Kanuku Mountains and you can see just the vastness of them, and you realise that you're going to cross them. And it's funny when you look at the jungle from a distance, just greenery, but you know that inside it's so dense and deep and damp, and it's just so unknown. You start to feel a little bit overwhelmed as you look at the scale of what you're about to go into. But meeting the team and meeting my friends of the Chinese and Lionel, some of the team for the first time in a couple of years, was so exciting. And it was funny, actually, because I hear from them, I start talking to them about the trip, and they tell me that they're family and their friends from their village had said, why are you doing this? Why are you going on this expedition? And because they thought that they would never return. And so I felt very honoured and trusted that these guys were putting their faith in me and Anders to sort of make this expedition a success. But it really shows you that they all had the adventure gene and they wanted to be a part of this, which was quite an honour, really. And they're such great guys. But also, it was great for them to all meet. We all looked at the maps. These maps, so I said they're 50 years old, but because of the distance is so vast, lying them out on the floor to have a look at our rough route. So we have a route, knowing where we're going to meet the resupplies, but the problem with the jungle is that you don't know how long it's going to take. You can look at resupply one, you can look at resupply two, but it might take 3 weeks, it might take 4 weeks. You don't know what's in there. The terrain is just, you have to be feet on the ground and you kind of have to adjust it every day. You can't plan the route more than that, really. But it was cool. We laid out all the maps. There was 12 maps. So it went, it was about 15 meters of maps that we were looking at, which was quite daunting as we sat there looking at them. But after a lot of admin, I mean, there's so much admin in all these expeditions, it was finally time to depart for our insertion point. And to get to our insertion point, it wasn't easy, and nothing is easy. So it would take, it took a day and a half in a 4x4, no roads, just sort of getting through the savannah. So the Kanuku Mountains are surrounded by the hot savannah. So we drove through that, and then we reached reached the rainforest, and would jump into a boat. And this boat was a 2.5 day journey. And this is where the adventure really began. Because the boats that we were using, we used two boats. They're long, thin aluminium boats. And they're very, very old. They've got dents. They're full of dents. And you pack them full of all your kits. You have your life jackets. It's very hot. It's very, very flat on the water at this point. And you jump in and you start going, making your way into the jungle. And we've got a very small motor, a 15 horsepower motor that we're using to go upstream. It's very hot on the water if you've ever been in the rainforest. It's a beautiful place to be when you're on rivers, but it's so, so hot. And I always think that when you're on the river, you see the pristine side of the jungle. And it's the place that is the idea that when we think of a jungle, we think of full of life, and we think of colourful wildlife jumping, fish jumping out of the water, wildlife in the trees, things like that, which you do get on the water. But as we're sitting in this boat, as it's going along, you look over to either side and you look into the canopy, and it's just black. And you know that in a couple of days after the boat ride, you're going to be stepping off. And you're going to be cutting trail into there. And it's a very, very different story to actually be walking rather than on the river. And the river that we were going on is the mighty Skibo River. And it's called Mighty because it's known for having a lot of rapids. So our insertion point would be at the point where the rapids just got so ridiculous, a place called King William's Falls. And it's here where, other than portaging the boats, a little bit on the way, they couldn't go any further than this. So this would be our start point. But as we were sort of a day away from this point, we start hitting some rapids, and they're fine, a bit of white water. We portage the boat a little bit and then get back in the boat. So portaging, if anyone doesn't know, means you drag the boat. It's pretty hard work, either by walking in the river or by getting it on land and pulling it. But on one occasion, we see some rapids, and I'm in the boat, the first boat going ahead, and it doesn't look too bad. But as we approach, they look much worse. They become much worse, and it's obvious that they're worse than we thought. And we have a boat captain and an assistant. And for some reason, the assistant was driving this boat at this point, and the engine stalls just at the wrong moment. But we've committed at this point. We've committed, so we have to keep going. So the engine starts again. We don't have the speed that we had. We're only using a 15 horsepower engine, which is absolutely nothing. We've got the wrong engine on this occasion. We take on the rapids, and it is much bigger. It was all hidden from the water. It's much bigger rapids than we thought. The boat flies up into the air, and doesn't it, we get air, but it doesn't clear the rapid, and we're basically stuck. The front of the boat is clear. The back of the boat, we've got white water coming. There's a whirlpool on the left. There's rocks on the left. White water is hitting the side, and we're stuck. And we're trying to use our weight. We're trying to rock it. We've got an oar. We're trying to paddle it. Because if we flip to the left, then it's a real serious scenario. These are some big rapids, and we could get either pinned to the rock, or we could just get sucked in and stuck. These boats are not meant to capsize. It's worth mentioning that. They don't capsize. It's just a thing that they don't do. And after a few seconds, well, actually, I say seconds, it was a couple minutes, felt like eternity. I was filming part of this, actually, and I realised that something was really seriously going to go wrong. Put the camera in my dry bag, thankfully, and after just a moment, the water caught it. We got catapulted out. We got flipped into the water. We were tumbling down. Luckily, we got flipped onto the right side. If we'd gone the left, it would have been seriously bad. We were tumbling underneath. We were trying to hold each other's hands. We couldn't. It was just too powerful, the water. I was holding onto my Camry dry bag, which gave me some buoyancy. And after a few seconds of just sort of trying to grasp for air, we popped out the other side. A miracle, we popped out the other side. No one was injured, amazingly. And the other boat came to rescue us. They came to rescue us, popped us on the rock in the middle of the river, and then went to start to retrieve the boat, retrieve the engine that had gone. And also bits and pieces that that were in the boat that were floating. And you know what? It was crazy, because if we had lost even one thing, one bag of that, everything we have, you know, we don't take anything unnecessary. So everything had something important: the sat phone, any food, the first aid kit, maps. If we'd lost one thing, that would have been the expedition over with, because we're such a small expedition, really. You know, it was just Anders and I, with a very small amount of sponsorship compared to the grandness and size of the actual expedition. And so it was a reminder that we are very much at the mercy of the jungle. And as I stood on that rock, some of my teammates were quite shaken up, actually. They're pretty shocked to have experienced that. I mean, these guys are amazing swimmers, but I think they knew the remoteness of what we were about to do, and it's just us out there, and we had to really respect it, and the water especially is a frightful place. But no one was hurt. We started portaging the boat until we couldn't anymore, and then we were finally dropped off. We said wave goodbye to Anders and the boat guys, and then I stood there finally in the damp and wetness of under the canopy. On one side, I had four guys. So my team, we were a team of five. And I had four guys all wearing our 35, 40 kilograms rucksacks. And they're looking at me to sort of navigate their way, our way through the jungle. And on the other side, I've just got this wall of forest and trees. And it's a very... jungles can vary very much in their denseness, but what we experienced for those first month or so was just so many, such dense. And when I say dense forest, I mean lots of small trees, lots of vines, lots of roots. So it's not just that you can use your machete to just cut once and then you step forward. You have to cut from all angles, and it's anything but walking is what we realized. So we started heading into the jungle, and I remembered very clearly why it takes a few weeks for your body to adjust, for you to get used to being in the jungle. I remembered that from before, but everyone says it's hot, everyone says it's sweaty, it most certainly is. But what you don't realize is just how slow it is. It takes a lot of, I think, mental resilience to just realize the pace that you're going at is slow, and you're streaming with sweat, especially to start with, as your body is starting to adjust. But you are crawling, so you're constantly having to crawl under into the floor, and the forest floor is, you can never see the forest floor, really. It's a bit, I describe it a bit like being in a compost heap. So you know, compost bin is very squishy. And it kind of smells, that rotting smell, and it's wet. So it's, you're constantly squishing down, and then you're crawling on the floor underneath trees, but also you're always having to keep so alert. There are obviously snakes that you're always watching out for, there's scorpions that you're watching out for, ants, spiky trees. We're constantly having to warn each other about spiky trees because they're needle-like trees everywhere that just splinter you and pierce you, that you spend the whole night getting out otherwise. It was slow progress for those first few weeks. Every night I would lie in my hammock and I would just stare up into the darkness, and you've got the howler monkeys in the distance. You've got the frogs making their big bellowing noise. And I would just think, how long am I going to be here? Because I try and maintain some sort of control, but there was no point in trying to do that. There was no point in trying to think, well, maybe we're going to average 2K a day from now on. Maybe that means we'll get to our resupply in 5 weeks, and then, oh gosh, will I be home for Christmas? This would all be going around in my head at night. But until I actually realized there's no point in doing that, I have to embrace the unknown, that's why I'm here, then it wasn't until then I could actually get some peace from it.
Was there a particular moment on that trip, because you've sort of spoken about the sort of hardship that you've been going through, and I imagine for listeners thinking, whoa. And I suppose, is there a sort of particular moment that you can remember on the adventure where you sort of sit back and sort of found this amazing moment along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. There were a couple moments of that. It's for such a long trip, and I'm thankful that there were. There was in the middle of the trip, the rainforest really changed, and it became, I sort of describe it like, Tomb Raider rainforest, that big rocks with vines coming down, and actually some of the sunlight could actually shine their rays down onto the floor, so you could actually feel the heat of the sun, which previously we hadn't had. We'd just been in the dark the whole time. It felt very much like how you would draw a jungle as a child, and there was a few times where we'd have a break and we'd be next to these huge rocks, and I'd sort of be climbing the vines and things like that, and in a way, you felt safe. You're never safe in the jungle, but because the sun, you felt the sun on your skin, you felt a little bit of light relief. And there was moments like that where we were just sort of playing, really, which was just so much fun. And other times where, as we got towards the mountainous section, we would have such, it was a slog to climb up mountains in the jungle. You try and grab hold of trees or rocks, but because the ground is so wet, anything just falls apart. You have to be very careful when you climb up, and it just falls out of your hand. But we get to the top and we'd occasionally have like a tiny view through the trees, and be able to see where we'd come from and just see these rolling forest-filled mountains. And one of my team, Vivian, he just goes up and he sees this and he goes, oh boy, I never ever believed that I would be this high up in the Kuniku Mountains, but here we are. And it was that sense of achievement that we would get. That was towards the end as well, where it's like, well, maybe this is within reach now, which was amazing, because we had so many times where it was close call and it could have ended so differently and tragically. I really felt like we got away with a lot. So much could have happened. Daily challenges we faced, really. Everything is a challenge. I mean, even just walking is hard, because let me try and explain what it's like to go through when you'll get to a very thick undergrowth bit and you'll start moving, but you'll realise your feet aren't actually on the ground. You're on some large bush or some large tree. Walking on lots of different branches, that if one of these breaks, you're just going to break a leg or anything like that. That would have meant the end of the expedition, because you have a broken leg. There's only so much you can do with that. But also, I mentioned snakes briefly, the Bushmaster snakes. They're meant to be quite rare. They are definitely not rare in this area. Bushmaster snakes are, they can grow up to 12 feet in length. We would see them in about 10 feet. Huge and very, very wide as well, but their camouflage is just so good that they'll be on the canopy floor and you just won't be able to see them. Or to the untrained eye, it's very difficult to see them. And that's the biggest threat that the team, if you ask them what they were scared of, they would say the Bushmaster snakes. They've got in the Amerindian culture, they're feared hugely. They whistle, these snakes whistle, so they have a two-tone whistle. When they hear you coming, they'll whistle and they'll tell each other. They often live in the mountains and the rocky areas. And we would be passing and the whistles would just start and they would be everywhere and they'd be very close as well. And so they were very much around, but then they also tend to get quite aggressive. So they're seen as quite aggressive snakes and they'll defend their territory. And of course, this is a place where humans, it's said that humans have never really been before. So it's very unlikely that these Bushmaster snakes have ever experienced humans. So they're scared. They're chasing. They're meant to chase you as well. They travel in pairs. At night, they have been known to curl underneath your hammock for your warmth, and then they strike when you least expect it. So they haven't got the best reputation. They also have a little pin, like one of their bone comes out of their tail, and they have been known that once they've bitten you, they jump on top of you and then whip you with their venomous bony tail, which is lovely. But we had quite a few moments where we'd be stepping. One moment in particular I'll describe is, so I was going third, Vivian was cutting trail, so cutting trail with the machete, cutting as much as he could. Then it was Lionel and I were chatting, and you always go in a single file, of course, and you leave a couple of meters distance between you, because if one person has sees a snake or there are wasps or bees, which there always are, then it gives you time to make a decision of which way you're going to go. And Lionel and I are chatting, you know, oh, well, what are you most afraid of in the jungle? And Lionel says, oh, venomous snakes, because you just can't see them. A lot of the other things, the jaguars, even the spiders, you'll see them because they move, but the venomous snakes, you do not see them. As soon as he said that, Vivian just yells, screams, he almost falls down. He drops his bow and arrow and his machete, and he luckily falls in the right direction, but there was a snake, the snake went for him. He had gone into sort of survival mode and dropped everything next to it, and he just shouts, Bushmaster, and we start having to run back where we come from, because they strike and they can jump quite a big distance. And it was just, okay, heart throbbing moment. This was the first time, so this was a couple weeks in, the first time we'd actually seen one as we were moving, so we hadn't seen it first. And the problem was that he dropped his tools right next to it, and we needed to get these tools. We couldn't just leave them. So we had to make a decision. This snake was being very aggressive towards us and towards Vivian, and we had its partner one. So they have this partner, and this partner, we couldn't see it, but it was in the bushes. So they like to live in lots of bushy thickness, and you could hear it in the distance, or close by actually. And it was whistling away, and we had to use our bow and arrow to get it away, to get Vivian's tools. But it was Vivian was sweating. He was really shaken up, because it so almost got him. I was there ready. I thought he'd been bitten to start with, so because I went, are you okay? And he went, no, I'm not. So I was like ready, about to start cutting down trees to get signal for the sat phone and get the first aid kit out and things like that. But yeah, luckily he was okay. And unfortunately, he had quite a few close calls with Bushmaster snakes. He's not a fan of them. Let's just say that. They've toyed with his life a little bit too much, Bushmaster snakes.
Wow, God, and jeez, what a sort of moment to sort of have. And you know, you had that throughout your entire journey. And so we're sort of moving along to sort of towards the end. You've been almost 50 days out in the jungle, you know, having to sort of deal with this on a daily basis. How, when you were sort of getting towards the end, what were the sort of feelings like within the group, and where were you?
Yeah, so as we got towards the end, we never sort of counted our chickens, so to speak, until we were really, really close to the end, because every step is something can happen. And, you know, we're also fighting things like skin infection, things like that, and it's it does become a point where every step is painful. You can manage it as much as you want, but when you don't have access to just rest and drying out things, it's just, it takes its toll. So every minute seems like a long time. But the last, I would say probably where we got to the last night, when we knew the next day, providing nothing, no accidents happened, then we would get to the end. That was a big moment because we'd run out of food again, because again you'd only take as much as you can possibly. But we're all lying in our hammocks that night. You go to bed quite early in the jungle. In fact, you go to bed very early in the jungle because it gets dark very quickly. It suddenly gets dark rapidly. And as soon as it gets dark, you should really be in your hammock getting off the ground from the snakes and the things you can't see. And it's a safety thing, really. But in the Kanuki Mountains, especially towards the end of this whole trip, it was very cold, surprisingly, very cold at night. And we'd all be sleeping in our hammocks on this last night. And I heard one of the team get up and start stoking the fire, and that he was just standing there next to the fire. And I thought, well, I'll get up because I'm freezing and we don't actually need sleep tonight. And then it ended up that a whole team got up. We all just spent the whole night around the fire, kind of this buzz of excitement and euphoria that we were actually going to do this and this was actually going to happen. And I think we stayed until around 4 a.m. and then we couldn't wait any longer, and we just decided let's just make our move and start making our way to the end. And there was a little bit of hesitation as we started, because we'd created this such family, just unusual family dynamic. Here I am, this the one that you might see as the odd one out, but in a way on some of them they were looking after me, but in a way I was looking after them, and in being in almost like a mother hen to some of the younger ones. And we had a funny relationship, an interesting relationship. I respected them, they would look after me, but then I would look after them and tell them the decision of what we were doing each day and where we were going and things like that. So it was very special, and I think they started to realize, I've got used to this routine so much and this jungle way of life, because of course these guys spend a lot of time in the jungle, but they don't, the max time that any of them had spent in the jungle in one go was 12 days, and that wasn't even moving every single day. So they live in the edges of the jungle and go in for different reasons frequently, but this was moving every single day for 50 days in just non-stop, no rest. And I think they got used to it, and they got used to just how we were doing things, and the idea of going back and being with their families and having the uncertainty of the world again. It gave them quite hesitation and sadness, I think, a little bit, just as it did to me. What was going to come? Yes, I couldn't wait to have the relief and be in safety. But yeah, anyone who does these sorts of things, you do it because you love it and it's addictive. And not to have it again was quite a scary scenario.
Yeah. And so what was the sort of view looking out, and when it all sort of came to an end?
So as we approached the end, just our last part really was, so we got to the top of the high point of the day, and we could finally see the savannah for the first time. So this, we were finally out of the jungle. We could also see Lethem. So that was actually where we started. We could see it again, because we'd gone backwards in a way. And yeah, that was the first sign of civilization. We saw what the end really, and then after that we just started making our way down for a few hours to the savannah out of the jungle. And it was coming out of the savannah, out into the savannah, you felt that heat onto you and the crunchness of the grass, rather than this wet and darkness and humidity. And yeah, it just felt such a relief, really.
Wow, God, what an amazing adventure. And God, do you keep in touch with the four guys that you went on this trip with? You are still in contact?
I do indeed. Yeah, so not all of them are easy to contact. Some of them don't have any technology or don't even know how to. I mean, some of them, we call them bushmen. You give them a phone and they have no idea what to do with it. But a couple of the others, Vivian and Mikey, younger guys, yeah, I'm in touch with them regularly. So they've installed Wi-Fi in their villages as a government scheme, so I can actually talk to them. And I was speaking with Vivian recently because we're collaborating, we're doing a a virtual talk together for something, which is great to give him that opportunity as well. So I'm definitely going to be back doing things with them. I think we've got some adventures up our sleeve.
And how did the 50-year-old maps compare to the real thing?
They were pretty accurate on the mountainous areas, because it kind of makes sense, because if he could see the contours and things like that. But low down, when we were in swamp like areas and trying to know where the creeks were, they just really weren't accurate. I think there's going to be, I expect within the next year or two, the LiDAR technology is going to improve so much that they will be really good. Because Google Maps tries with their contour lines and things like that, but I think LiDAR should be able to show us where the water is. That's the biggest thing. When you're in the jungle, you need water source every night in order to wash, in order to get water. And if you kind of know where that is, you can base, right, we're going to try and walk 2 kilometers today. Again, doesn't sound very much, but that's kind of a good day in that jungle. I think in the next couple of years, it's going to be pretty good.
I think everyone sort of underestimates, just, you know, like when we look at a Google map here and we think, oh, you know, walk 20 miles. Okay, that'll probably take about a day or something. In jungle, everyone always underestimates.
Definitely. And I think you just shouldn't have a number in your head for the day. Otherwise, it's much worse to be like have sort of high expectations and not get there, for your mental health is bad. So just think, right, I'm going to walk 8 hours for today. I'm just going to see what happens. I think that's the best way to approach any jungle
journey. And did it take long to sort of come back to the UK and sort of recover after sort of 50 days of being in the jungle, machetering away? Is that the word? Machetering?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose macheting. Yes, I reckon we can get away with that word. It was a bit of a whirlwind when I got back. I've sort of finished, and we had a lot to do in the country in terms of go and see people, shake lots of hands, and do interviews and things like that. And then the same happened when I got back. So it wasn't really. I had sort of 3 weeks of nonstop just talking about an exhibition that I hadn't even had time to digest yet and reflect. So I was just repeating the same. I sort of selected 3 stories that I could remember. It's funny, when you finish an expedition, you're thinking, well, what happened? because you haven't had time to actually think what happened. So I just picked a couple things, and then a few weeks later, I actually had time to stop, reflect, and think, okay, wow, we did it.
Yeah, I think when you sort of get back from these trips, you need that sort of time to reflect on the sort of feelings, because when you're fresh out of it, you're sort of either on a massive high or a massive low. And mm-hmm. So that sort of reflects in what you sort of portray very early on. But actually, once you go back, think about it, think about what you've done, you sort of have time to sort of gather your thoughts and actually be able to sort of tell the actual story in the way that you want to tell it.
100%. And also gives you time to understand what you've learned and why you did it. And not trying, by reflecting, I think you're less likely to get that low that we talk about. It's very easy to get low after a trip. But if you can take the good bits that you learn out of it, and how can you do, you know, not that again, not, you're never going to do the same trip again, but how can you, the things that you loved about it and the things that you really want to emphasize and harness in the future things, then what's that going to entail? So I think that's what I've been doing ever since I got back from that trip, and why I haven't sort of jumped in to deciding exactly what I'm doing next year until now, as I start to hone in on it.
Well, what an incredible story. And you know, for people listening, I'm sure they will be more intrigued about the Guyana rainforest and heading out there in no time at all.
Absolutely. No, it's a beautiful, beautiful country.
Well, there's a part of the show where we ask 5 questions to each guest each week. A bit different from last time you were here.
Absolutely. Yeah, looking forward to it.
With the first being, what does it mean to have purpose?
I think to have purpose is, it's a reason to get up in the morning. It drives you, and it also makes you feel like you're doing exactly what you should be doing. Personally.
Oh, amazing. And might be slightly different from the last episode that you were on, but what is your favorite quote?
I think it's probably the same quote. I'm going to say it's, yeah, I believe it's the same quote. Amelia Earhart, which is the quote of adventure is worthwhile in itself. And for me, I think you can just do adventure for yourself. It doesn't have to have lots of other reasons as well. So if you want to do an adventure, just go for it. You don't have to answer to anyone.
Very nice. And what is your favorite travel book and why?
My favorite travel book and why? Maybe it's an unusual one. Maybe it's not. It's Mad, Bad and Dangerous to Know. I don't know if that's a travel book, but it's Ranulph Fiennes. And it was a book that is a book that changed me because it's sort of just filled with so many different stories. And it shows you that you can have so many different adventures in a lifetime. You don't just have to have one, and they can come in all different forms and sizes. So that inspired me personally.
Amazing. And why are these sort of adventures that you undertake so important to you?
These adventures are important to me for lots of different reasons. For myself personally, I think it's I am the best version of myself when I do these adventures. And I know without a doubt that I am a better human being when I do these expeditions and these adventures and then grow with it. So that's one reason. But also, I hope that by sharing what I do can inspire other people to get outside. I think by being outside, we have more of a connection to the outside world, and maybe, just maybe, you'll want to protect it and share your passion for it as well.
Very nice. And in your lifetime, what is the most memorable place that you've been and why?
The most memorable place I have been and why in my lifetime? Probably Svalbard. Svalbard up in the Arctic is where it all started for me. And it's a place that when the sun is shining, there's 100% visibility, and you're just skiing along with a polk with a sled behind you. There's nothing quite like it. It's just spectacular, sublime scenery, and you just feel so at one. It sounds quite hippie and cheesy, but I can't. Yeah, it's an incredible place, and to go back there recently again was a very humbling experience. So if you get the chance to go, do try and go.
When you're sort of skiing along, is it a sort of silence that sort of greets you, or is it just the sound of the wind? What can you sort of hear when you're up there skiing along?
So when you're skiing along, you have this very specific sound of your skis, just so your skis moving back and forth. And yeah, you'll have a little bit of wind coming through through your hat and through up and down the mountains. But it's that crisp snow that you're gliding through really comes to mind when I think of Svalbard and think of Arctic polking.
Very nice. And finally, how can people follow you and find you, Lucy, and follow your big adventures for the future?
So people can find me on lucy-shepherd.com, and I'm Lucy Sheps on social media.
Very nice. Well, Lucy, it's been an absolute pleasure getting you on again and listening to your stories.
No, thank you very much. It's been a huge pleasure to share it, and it's always nice to relive going back to the jungle.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully we'll have you back on soon for your big adventure next year or the year after, whenever it may be.
Absolutely. Yeah, now I've got lots to come. So yeah, I look forward to sharing that too.
Amazing. Well, Lucy, thank you so much again.
Thank you. It's been really, really appreciate it. It's great to talk.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and don't forget to subscribe and review the podcast if you're listening on Apple. A massive thank you to those who reviewed it. And I hope to see you next week for another fascinating tale of adventure. But till then, have a great day wherever you are in the world, and happy adventures.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.